You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. This week, Mickey Mantle retired, and it was also the anniversary of the oddest trade in baseball history. That's when Yankees teammates, pitchers Mike Kekich, number 18 in your program, and Fritz Peterson, number 19 in your program, decided to trade lives, wives and children and cars and dogs, everything. Can you imagine being in the public relations department of the New York Yankees when this happened? Imagine no more. Marty Appel was the assistant public relations director and joins us now in studio, as you can all see, the first in-studio guest in the long award-winning history of this show, all 3 weeks of it. Marty, great to have you.
Thank you, Ed. Always good to be with you.
This arrangement, let's first talk about Kekich and Peterson. Okay. This arrangement apparently began during an off-season party hosted by one of the team's writers.
I guess you could say that, but it really began during the 1972 season when the two couples, the Petersons and the Kekich, began to spend a lot of time together and came to realize that they were in love with each other's spouses. And it wasn't something that they were open, you know, could openly just talk about to each other. It was a growing feeling. And during the off season between 72 and 73, they finally came to the realization that they were all four of them were going to be happier if they made this momentous switch. It came to a head at a party of Maury Allen, the New York Post columnist and sports writer, at his home in Dobbs Ferry in Westchester County. And the four of them left the party and stood in the driveway for a very long time discussing the logistics of what they were about to undertake. And Maury and Janet Allen kept looking out the window. Are they still in the driveway? What's going on there? Mm. And what was going on there was a monumental social occurrence in the baseball landscape. It was the very first few days of spring training before the hitters reported. Peterson was holding out and was not in camp. Kekich was. The story was revealed to Milton Richman, the UPI sports editor, and gradually it became known. Now, this takes on so many different directions apart from the lives involved with the children and everything. It fell on us as the Yankee PR department to sort of handle it, something we were totally unprepared for, of course.
Of course. But when did you first get wind of this?
Okay, well, my boss was Bob Fischel, and his boss was Lee McPhail, the general manager. McPhail was informed by Mike Kekich what was going on. McPhail told Bob Fischel that we're going to have to figure out how to deal with the media on this. And there it became interesting because it's going to sound like such a primitive time, but the strategy was we would call all the reporters into Ralph Houck's office,
the
Yankees manager.
Right.
And we would just tell them what had happened and tell them this is a very personal matter. It's not for publication. It's just between them, and we just wanted you guys to know, and we wanted to ask you guys to please not report it. And so the four regular beat writers who were there agreed. Mm-hmm. What we foolishly had to deal with, foolish on our part, was that the New York Post, that particular spring, didn't send one of their regular writers to spring training that early. They decided to send Sheila Moran, a woman feature writer who wasn't even a sports writer, to cover the early days of spring training just to get a different look.
At a time in which the women's lib movement had just begun to blossom.
Well, there weren't women allowed in the clubhouse yet. There were all these other issues. We never saw a woman on the beat in 1973. But she found out that she was excluded from this meeting. And, all hell.
She went wild.
Yeah, all hell broke loose, understandably. So the Post led with the story then once she got it. and everybody had to scramble and catch up, and it was just ugly all around. The writers were mad at us for not containing the story with Sheila Moran.
The editors at their newspapers were mad that they were sitting on the story and they'd been beaten.
And the Post felt great that they, you know, they happened to have the right person on the scene.
On the front page of the newspaper, not the back page of
a
tabloid.
It was the front page for several days, and there had been a team outing the summer before on an off day on the Schaefer Beer Yacht. And there was a great picture of the four of them just, you know, out on the yacht for the day. So that was the picture to go with. Today, this would, with all the, you know, tabloid magazine shows and everything, this would not have gone away for a long time. And then it was a 4 or 5 day story, which was pretty enormous. And it, you know, finally subsided. Kekich got traded, which was heartbreaking for him because he was now going to leave his kids back with his ex-wife. And it was such a mess, but it was...
But also this was happening to such a conservative franchise.
Well, yeah.
And Lee McPhail, the general manager, such a conservative man. And this was earth-shaking.
Well, you could go to most churches and find, you know, that there's scandal somehow in the background. Things happen. Peterson and Kekich were hardly conservative, though. Pete Sheehy, our clubhouse man, if somebody acted erratically, he would like flick his left wrist as though, well, that's what you would expect from left-handers. Somehow he equated odd behavior with being left-handed.
And they were both left-handed.
And they were both left-handed.
Against the background of some guy named George Steinbrenner,
yep.
Who said he was not going to be actively involved in the operation of the ball club, had, along with his group, just acquired the franchise from CBS only 7 weeks before.
That's correct. In early January, they bought the team. He might have been heard from, but he hadn't yet been approved at an American League meeting as an owner. So minding that, he had nothing to say on the subject, and it fell on the still the CBS people who were there, Mike Burke and Lee McPhail.
Now, you have a multitude of jobs with the Yankees, which also involves authority over the yearbook. And back in the day, they used to have family day pictures.
Right.
And the Yankees would have a family day with the players and their wives and their children on the field, and everybody would think this was wonderful. This certainly took on a new meaning.
Well, it forced the cancellation of family day, which actually had been scheduled.
Really? You took it off the schedule?
Took it off the schedule. And then I remember, this is such a small thing to remember, but in the centerfold of our press guide, where it said, you know, height and weight, bats and throws, hometown and all that, we had a column for married or single and number of children. And
did anybody else? Nobody else had that, did they?
Nobody else had it, but
no,
I didn't
clubs.
Even realize it. We had carried it over year after year. I didn't know that was in there. So now we're faced with, we hadn't gone to press yet. This was still so early in spring training. Mm-hmm. And we said, well, let's lop out those two columns because how are we going to show marital status for Peterson and Kekich?
Yeah.
So we lopped
single
off those.
Single married traded.
Yeah. So we lopped off those two columns, and only then, as press guides started to arrive from other teams, did I look and notice that we were the only ones doing it.
And also, in your yearbook, were pictures beside Family Day of families.
Sure.
That had to go too, right?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Well, not everybody's. I mean, you know, we still had family pictures of other players, but it was such an uncomfortable situation in the clubhouse. The players really didn't know how to react to them. They knew them, they knew their wives, and it was just very difficult, which is why one of them, Kekich, had to be traded. And the following year, Peterson was traded. But it was just very awkward and silent in the clubhouse. And
oh, it must have just fractured the clubhouse.
Yeah, it was very difficult.
When they made this arrangement, the Kekiches and the Petersons, did they put an out in this arrangement for either couple?
Well, it wasn't spelled out so specifically, but I can tell you that Fritz Peterson and the former Susan Kekich have been married for 43 years or so.
Right.
And Mike Kekich and Marilyn Peterson didn't last the month. They never married. They quickly wanted to undo everything and go back the way things were, but it was too late. But that one didn't take.
Can you imagine what that would be like today with reality TV,
I know.
With sports talk radio, with the internet? Oh, my God.
I know. Bob Fischel had a dinner to go to that very night that the story broke, and I was kind of left at a very young age, I would say. I was like 24, to deal with this, with people calling from news desks all over the country wanting comment. And really, the best we could do was, reiterate that it was a personal matter between them, between the two couples, but certainly not something that the Yankees as an organization would encourage or condone. Very un-Yankee-like behavior for the conservative organization that it was, or the conservative industry that we were in.
And as luck would have it, Kekich goes to Cleveland June 12, 1973, and then Fritz Peterson follows the following April when the Yankees trade four pitchers to the Indians to bring Chris Chambliss and Dick Tidrow to New York.
Right, and Cecil Upshaw.
And Cecil Upshaw, which became a great trade for the Yankees, but now they're in Cleveland.
I'm in touch with Fritz a lot. He's a good friend all these years later. And I've apologized to him several times for just sort of leaving them out there without any PR support. I was working for the team. I wasn't working for him. And we kind of let them hang out there to dry in a very difficult situation.
This was unprecedented.
It was unprecedented.
And unimaginable on top of unprecedented.
True. But I'm still in touch with Fritz. He's a good guy. He writes books now and has very candid memories of all his old teammates and everything, a little unorthodox, even the books that he's written. But both of them were extremely likable, and it broke my heart that, such an awkward situation didn't come out right because it didn't work for Kekich and Mrs. Peterson.
I was in the Pacific Coast League in Spokane when it was AAA. And one of our seven left-handed pitchers on our pitching staff, believe it or not, was Mike Kekich. And we became friends. I never brought it up. All I like to tell people about my time with Mike Kekich in Spokane was that he held the Pacific Coast League record for most minutes in the team dryer. He got in the big team dryer to see how long he could go before he got a little bit too hot. Marty Appel is with us. He was the former assistant public relations director for the New York Yankees, talking about the oddest trade of all time when Fritz Peterson and Mike Kekich this week in 1973 traded wives and children and cars and dogs and insurance policies and everything else. And now this week also, now let's go on to the retirement of Mickey Mantle. More than 2,400 hits, 536 of them home runs, and one of baseball's mythic figures. And you came to the Yankees, your first job was working with Mickey Mantle.
It's true. And for a kid who grew up in New York as a Yankee fan, and like every other Yankee fan, idolized Mickey Mantle. What a thing that was for me.
You wrote a letter to the team.
I wrote a letter to Bob Fischel, the PR director, and he hired me ostensibly to answer Mickey Mantle's fan mail.
What did you say in the letter? What did you say in the letter?
There was a little humor in there. I said, this may be the earliest application from a right-handed typist, but I would welcome a chance to work with you in any capacity as the summer job when I'm off from college. And if you would consider this an application, I'd really be appreciative. My feeling was when I wrote that letter that I'll never get an answer because it's the New York Yankees.
Right.
I must get 500 letters like this a week. But you know what, Ed? In the late 60s, baseball was not really hot with college kids and,
the world was changing in the late 60s.
Yeah, and baseball was in a really down period with young people. It was really, there was a chance of losing a whole generation. So mine was not one of 500 letters. It was one of one.
Wow.
And on the day that it arrived, so too did Pete Sheehy roll in a hand dolly with like five cartons of unanswered fan mail. And Bob Fischel knew that this mail had to be answered, or these were going to be Mets fans.
And we should mention, Pete Sheehy was the legendary clubhouse man.
Yes.
Going back to the days of Babe Ruth.
Absolutely. So there's my letter on Bob Fischel's desk, and there's five cartons of unanswered fan mail. And Bob Fischel called and asked me to come in for an interview, which I did. The interview went well. I told him I had won one of his scorecard contests the summer before, and he loved that. And the fact that I was a young person who cared about the Yankees and about baseball made a big impression on him, because he knew what the demographics of the game were at that time. So I got hired, and I did other things besides fan mail, but mostly it was the fan mail, and most of the fan mail said the same thing: please send me an autographed baseball. But nevertheless, I'd always managed to save up three or four letters that I had to go over with Mick in person, so I'd get quality time with Mickey Mantle, you know. So Mick caught on to this right away. He may have been from Commerce, Oklahoma, but he knew a phony act when he saw one. And here comes Appel with some more fan mail. So he took a liking to me. We sort of shared that as an ongoing laugh. And the story that I like to tell, because all these years later it means so much to me, he took a liking to me to the point where he would give me all his gift certificates that he received for doing pre- and post-game radio shows. And he'd even bring them back from road trips so that I'd get $10 off Tom McCann's shoes the next time I was in Chicago. And I wish I'd had him just sign all the gift certificates and I would have kept them, but I used them.
That's great. So you began by answering his mail, and now it's 1969, it's spring training, and he chooses to officially retire in Fort Lauderdale where the Yankees were training in the days before spring training that year.
A lot of people at the time thought it was a Yankee trick that they hadn't announced the retirement the whole winter so that it wouldn't affect season ticket sales.
Right.
First of all, season ticket sales were so small in those days, we may not have thought of them like that, but I actually remember the number because we would get these sheets in advance of each homestand that showed the advance sale. And of course, the season ticket sale never changed. And it was always 3776 every day. That was the season ticket sale, 3,776 tickets. Which, since most of them were actually fours, you could divide that number by four to see how many people actually bought season tickets. Very small number. So, I don't know, maybe there was some discussion about not announcing it until the season was about to start. But Mickey knew that he was done, and he knew he was done because he did 237 in 1968, and he just couldn't hit anymore.
And he said he couldn't hit anymore.
And sometimes I'll make a talk, and somebody will say, you think with the DH, Mickey could have kept playing? And I would say, no, that was his worst part of his game, was hitting. He couldn't hit anymore.
Right.
And he was so embarrassed by that, too.
I'm sure so. And also, he seldom took batting practice the year before, right? 1968.
Yeah, 68, of course, was the year I got to know him, and I was there every day. And he would arrive a little late and spend a lot of time wrapping his legs with ace bandages and didn't go out to hit very often. And he must have...
Which really must have disappointed the fans, because fans were showing up early to see him hit moonshots.
All 80.
But all his friends, all eight fans, but all his friends were gone.
That's what I would say. He would look around the clubhouse and it would be like, who are these guys? Who is Andy Cosco? Who is Thad Tillotson?
Right.
And
Whitey had left in 67. Maris got traded after 66. Richardson retired after 66. Kubek was gone after 65. Howard Elston got traded in 67. They were all gone. Yogi was at the Mets.
Whitey was still a pitching coach. He was around. But basically, it was, who are these guys? To Mickey's credit, even though he really didn't know his teammates now, when somebody new arrived, Mick would walk across the clubhouse to shake the guy's hand and welcome him to the Yankees. And he'd just say, "Hi, I'm Mick," though the guy
wow.
didn't know.
Yeah.
I mean, what an awesome thing if you're Steve Whitaker or if you're, you know,
exactly.
somebody brand new.
Everybody has always talked about what a great teammate he was. But
yeah.
his last good season was at age 32
right.
in 1963. And this is the spring of 69.
Yeah, 64 he had a good season. And he was 30. But you're right, he was 32. And he was 36 when he was done. And look at how Aaron and Mays kept playing and playing.
Into their
40s.
Yeah. I know. And he always regretted the fact that he said, I'm sure to you, but he said it to me, that I should have left at 33. I shouldn't have continued playing till 36. And then that had a statistical component to it because he wanted to finish with a career 300 average. And you have an interesting story about that.
Well, I was in the PR office, and Bill Kane, our statistician, who used to type up the daily stats on his stencils and run them off on a mimeograph machine. But this one particular day, he came out and he said,
"You know, it's funny because people are listening to this on the internet going, what the hell are these two guys talking about?
I know.
Stencil machines." Yeah, go ahead.
A footnote on the mimeograph machine is Gabe Paul was late to embrace Xeroxing. And he had me go out and buy like the last mimeograph machine sold in America. And I remember the night we signed Catfish Hunter, I printed out the release on the mimeograph machine and got ink all over my shirt.
Stencils.
But I digress. So Bill Kane came out of his office and said, unless Mick does something miraculous this weekend, like go 8 for 10, he's going to drop under 300 this weekend, and he's not going to come back. We're seeing nothing in his game that says he's going to recover.
Mm.
So that was the weekend that he fell under 300, and that was one of his great regrets.
Right, that he never finished it at 300. What an amazing baseball life you've had.
Very fortunate. To my own credit, to toot my own horn for a second, I was 19 when I started, and I loved baseball, and I loved the surroundings. And I was the first day I was there, I met sports writers who I'd been reading since I was a little kid, some of them who went back to covering baseball in the 20s,
sure.
like John Drebinger, Dan Daniel. I met Harold Rosenthal. I met Maury Allen that first day.
But those first guys you mentioned, they saw and covered Ruth and Gehrig and Murderers Row.
But the point I'm making is I was 19, and I knew baseball history, and I knew baseball history was being made around me every day. And I wanted to appreciate every moment of it, and I did. I listened, and I asked questions, and I got to know these people.
Mm.
And that was very smart on my part, as it turns out, because today's kids, God love them, especially the ones that love baseball, they don't really know whether Lou Gehrig was before Mickey Mantle or not. They know today's game, but I'm not sure they really know the history of the game as we did.
Right. But how lucky you were to be a part of this, and especially on this momentous week, first week in March back in... back in 1973 with the pitchers and with Mickey Mantle in 69. Was it, just one further thing about the Mantle and the retirement. What was the atmosphere like? Was it sadness?
Yeah, there was kind of a hushed silence to the room. It was in the in the clubhouse in Fort Lauderdale Stadium, which was the largest room that there was there. Mickey looked very handsome that day. In those years immediately after his retirement, he really looked great.
Mm.
And, he said all the right things, but he was the most honest man you'd ever meet in your life. And he just said, "I can't hit anymore. I can't go out there and help this team if I can't hit." And so that produced a sadness because people in the room grew up with Mickey Mantle as this kid who could run and hit and do everything, and now he couldn't anymore. So it was sort of their own lives passing in front of them, too.
But to be an eyewitness to that, what a privilege.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming in.
Always a pleasure, Ed.
Marty Appel for us. So that'll do it for us on MLB.com. If you were listening on the move, thanks so much for the ride, and thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.